Hello, I'm Kelly Gardner, and you're listening to Imagining the Past. Imagining the Past is a sneak preview of some of the writers and issues showcased in this year's conference of the Historical Novel Society of Australasia. In Parramatta, New South Wales, from the 25th to the 27th of October 2019, the conference offers craft workshops and 2 days of panel sessions, interviews and conversations. It's for writers and readers of historical fiction. You'll hear from a huge range of authors: Jackie French, Paula Morris, Anna Campbell, Pamela Hart, Ali Elizadeh, Meg Keneally, Kate Forsyth, and many more. The weekend also features academic panels and demonstrations of historical weapons. You can find out more at hnsa.org.au. In this podcast series, I'll be talking to some of our conference guests about writing and reading historical fiction. Alison Goodman is the author of 7 novels, including her most recent release, Lady Helen and the Dark Days Deceit, the final novel in her award-winning Regency Supernatural Trilogy. The other books in the series are Lady Helen and the Dark Days Club and Lady Helen and the Dark Days Pact, all published internationally. Eon and Iona, her fantasy duology, were New York Times bestsellers. She's currently working on a new Regency series and has embarked on a PhD focusing on the Regency era and historical fiction research.
Welcome to Imagining the Past. Thank you very much. So it's historical, but it's fantastic. So how do you blend your historical with your fantastical in Lady Helen books?
The blending is where the real challenge is, of course, because it's a mashing together of two genres that I think they do have in common this need to build a very believable world. So I think that, and setting is something that they share in the terms of what is reader expectation. So it fits together nicely there. But when you're blending the two together, it's a bit of a juggling act. When you're mashing any genre together, it's a juggling act. Which set of conventions are you going to use or subvert? So there's those constant, which convention is coming to the fore? Which one am I going to be using at this point? So I think when blending, it all starts with a kind of a series of questions for me. And those questions start off with, firstly, from where does the magic grow? And because when I'm writing something that's not historical and magical, then the magic can come from anywhere. But with historical, I think that it's more important that the magic comes from that era or earlier, because that feels more coherent, it feels more organic. So if you're writing perhaps something like in the Enlightenment, then those kind of scientific discoveries can be melded in to the kind of magic that we're talking about. So if you're writing earlier, then, you know, what are the things that are around at that time that can be used as the basis for the magic? And that way, when you're researching that historical period, you could think, well, what is the thinking? What is the main kinds of thinking at that time? And use those. So, you know, perhaps if you're working in the 18th century, how does bleeding fit into the magic? Yeah, it doesn't fit into the magic. So those kind of questions can be asked. So once you've decided where and what your magic is going to be, then the questions start happening, because, of course, it's all about what if and what happens next. Is it hidden or is it out in the world? Is that magic hidden or out in the world? And once that's decided, then that starts to channel you in certain directions in ways that you can create character and who knows about it if it's hidden. Who are the practitioners? Is it, you know, stratified by society, you know, by the society's class, things like that? So it's, you know, you're going to get these kind of rolling questions that are going to take you forward into your own magic system. And this is where I stop and say, take notes all along, because it's very, very easy to get lost in your own magic system.
So you have to research your own thinking, if you like.
Yeah.
To take notes about your own world building.
Yeah. And yeah, some of them may fall away as other decisions are made and things like that. But to keep track of the perimeters of your own magic system is very important, because in the end, and I always find this, and I always say this, is that your magic system will come back and bite you in the butt. because it is, well, it's made up and it's going to have some kind of limitations on it because, you know, and I use Captain Marvel as an example of this. Captain Marvel is extraordinarily powerful. In fact, so powerful that we haven't yet seen any limitation to her powers. So in the Marvel movies, she has to go away into another area of the universe during the big fights because she would just lay everything to waste. So remember that limitations and the payment of working with magic system or superpowers has to be thought of as well, because without those limitations, you've just got a character who can just lay waste throughout the whole book and not create any of the drama.
Mm. So does that mean that you're a plotter, aren't you?
I'm a plotter.
So while you're planning your book, you are doing historical research, and in this case, Regency.
That's right.
Meticulous Regency research, which we'll talk about in a minute. But you're also world building in a fantasy sense at the same time, and they're blended together.
Yeah, they are.
Even at the research
stage. Even at the research stage. So when I'm researching the historical facts and stories and things like that, I am always got my radar open. Oh, that's interesting. I could use that within the magic system. When I created the creatures within the Lady Helen series, I wanted them to come out of this interesting space that just opened up in the Georgian era, which was the rambunctious kind of Georgian era had evolved into the very civil, very mannered Regency era. So that a lot of that kind of lewd behaviour was no longer seen as being appropriate. And I thought, well, within that is a lot of suppression. So those creatures feed on the suppressed emotion that the Regency folk are experiencing because they are attempting to be civil and to have these beautifully elegant manners. But underneath, they're just wanting to lay waste to everything around them and have sex and drink and go back to their Georgian ways. So within that nice little space was where I could fit my magic system and my creatures.
Right. And you're famous for your meticulous Regency research, even including reenacting.
Yes.
Like making clothes or fashion items and wearing them and learning the dances and all that sort of stuff. And I know that you recently even went to you've done it a couple of times, the Jane Austen Ball in the Guildhall at Bath, which is the most Austen thing to do that I can possibly imagine. So you tell us a little bit about that practical kind of research and how what you learn from that that helps you with writing.
Yeah, I don't actually make the clothes because I'm an awful sewer. So I have taken on the Regency style of hiring a mantua maker to make clothes for me. But I do have a wardrobe.
And you understand how they're made and all that.
Yes, yes. And the corsetry. And so all of that I have in my wardrobe. And learning the dancing was very much an early part of the process for me because it's so important in the Regency. That is where people met. That was where men and women could touch each other, albeit through silk gloves. That's where they could talk privately in a sense, although they were completely on show on the dance floor. So it was their epicenter of relationships and matchmaking. So I thought, well, I would like to know how that process went. And of course, you know, when you're doing these practical exercises, you can never get to that point. That was, of course, that time, because we're not in that time. We're in 2019 and we bring with ourselves all our 2019 emancipations and thoughts and secularism and things like that. But I try and take a step closer. That's what I think of it as taking a step closer to that time. And the dancing was a surprise because it was extremely communal. There was a sense of official, if that's the right word, even amongst, you know, the strangers that were dancing there, because there's a lot of eye contact and there is not a lot of body contact. So it's, you know, as you're passing someone, you're meant to lock eyes and you're meant to keep that eye contact until you've moved off into the next figure. So there's this kind of, suddenly you're looking into someone's eyes And you're keeping that because we don't often lock eyes for a very long time. So, and you're doing a very elegant movement. You think, I feel very elegant. I feel very fabulous, you know. And there is this kind of sheer, and Jane Austen calls it the felicity of movement, or motion, the felicity of motion. You know, there is this sense of breathlessness because the dancers are very robust. They're not the kind of stately trudges that we can sometimes see. They are full-on cardio exercise. So there is, you know, you're dancing, you're creating beautiful shapes, you're, you know, there's a sense of blood rushing through you. And I found that that was so important for my writing because I realized, oh, I see, this is all leading up to chatting with a guy, you know, or chatting with a girl, you know. It was kind of like that was what was all leading up to it. It was all very intimate in a very public way.
Mm. So when you're at a ball like that, are people also practicing the manners?
It was interesting you say that because the ball that we went to, my husband and I went to, and he is a trooper, he dressed up completely in the same blessing. It was the hottest day in Bath for many, many
years.
Yeah, I was in full silk and corsetry, all of it, and he was in the wool suit. And it was 29 degrees in Bath, which doesn't seem a lot to an Australian audience. Oh, yeah, that's all right. But it was English heat and it was bouncing off Bath's very light coloured stone. So it was really hot. And we got into the ballroom and my husband, who is not a reenactor and he does this for the love of me, bless him, pulls off his jacket. He's out of there. And the MC said, gentlemen, do not remove their jackets here at all during the ball, and pointing to my husband. And then the caller of the dancer said, I think it was David. David, we're letting the gentlemen take their coats off because we don't want the ambulance arriving. So what? But
normally they would.
Yes, normally they would. Curtsies were exchanged. Curtsies and bows were exchanged. All the honours. I was asked by a gentleman to dance and it was all very formal. And, you know, that was, you know, I mean, everyone was there in costume. Not everyone was there in all seriousness, but there was enough seriousness for them to actually take on those kind of civilities. Yeah, it was lovely.
And I suppose you also get a physical experience of hearing the silk move, feeling the corsetry, feeling the sweat inside the corsetry, all those sorts of things that you could work.
I learned a very interesting thing, which was because I had a chemise and I had a corset. And I had left off one petticoat, but the gown I was wearing was lined. And I danced every dance, just like Lydia. And it was a full workout. And there was a lot of, because I didn't have my corsetry tight, really tight, but, you know, it does constrict you a little bit. So there was like a bit of panting. And when I got home and I started to take off the gown and that, the chemise and the corset were wet from the sweat. I mean, they were wringing wet and had to be peeled off. But the gown was immaculate. And I realized, I see. So all of this padding underneath was soaking up the sweat because the dance hall, the dance and the ballrooms were always very hot just by the sheer number of people. The number of candles above dripping hot wax and that kind of heat bouncing off white ceilings usually. And they often had a fire in the grate. So there was a lot of heat happening and, of course, all the exercise. So I thought, oh, I see. They, in everyday life, obviously, but also during a ball, this would preserve the delicate materials of the ball gown and everything else would just be wringing wet.
And preserve the...
The ladylike, yes. There was some glowing in the face, but...
What about understanding things like how Lady Helen can actually swing a sword and move when she has to run?
Yes.
And although, of course, it's Empire line mostly, isn't it?
It is Empire.
Relatively free.
Yeah, there was relatively free in the gown. It's not so much that the gown, when you run... it does have an effect on your legs and that, but actually moving backwards is a lot harder because you can step on your hem and then you just go over. So there was those restrictions, but the actual real restrictions is the fact that you are dressed as a woman. So what you are able to do and what you were seen as being able to do was immediately restricted. That a woman of like in this particular clothing, because it was all very class, you could tell someone's class and someone's almost someone's monthly income by what they wore, so if a woman of Lady Helen's quality was suddenly in this area, there would be, why is she there? Which is why I take her into male clothing, but also for that kind of exploring that kind of what would happen to Helen if she was in something in breeches and a jacket in the second book. So, and that was fun to explore that, but also what that brings to her and what it doesn't.
Let's talk about her a little bit, because one of the reasons I love her is that, unlike many Regency heroines, she's not the feisty, rebellious girl at the beginning. Is she? She's like, oh, it's my job to get married. And
yeah, she's not against being married. She understands duty, and duty is very important to her. She's got enough backbone to be interesting. But there is this throughout the books, because I wanted her obstacles to grow from her context, really. And the fact is that it was duty. The idea of the individual wasn't so well developed, if at all, really. So there was duty and family, and what one wanted for oneself was generally put aside, generally. But there's obviously this all throughout history. There's people who are doing their own thing and paying a social price for it. But Helen, she loves her aunt. You know, she wants to keep the family name clearer than it has been in the past.
We can't discuss it on account of spoilers.
Yes, yeah, spoilers. She is not that kind of straight out the gate, I hate my life and I want to be an outlaw.
But she's called in a way. She's chosen.
Yeah, she is. And
she gets the call to adventure.
She gets the call to adventure in the form of probably in Lord Carston. She's not that impressed.
So, classic Darcy moment. Do you see him as Darcy?
I see him probably more of a Georgette Heyer girl. So I see him more as Lord Avon from the These Old Shades, mixed with a lot of other influences in that kind of romance, Regency kind of genre. Also a bit of Avon, lots of Avons from Blake Seven, but yeah, that's all I know.
You're a Regency nerd and a sci-fi nerd.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah.
Which is perfect. But the structure of their relationship and the way that it plays out over the books and the tensions between them are both Regency, aren't they, and very, very modern. And so is that another way that you're trying to integrate those different elements?
Yeah. I mean, to actually have a true Regency lady probably wouldn't take the call to adventure so readily. I mean, she does take it on quite readily and tries to deal with all these things that are happening to her, because she's having physical changes as well. Their relationship, well, it's a slow burn, and it's a very slow burn. I mean, it's not an insta love or anything like that. It's like, nor is it distaste on sight. You know, it's more of distrust on sight. So the Regency aspects of it are that, there is this inability for them to voice anything really, and to touch and do, let alone kiss if they decided they wanted to. And that was interesting ways of having to get around that, because when I was working with the characters, their manners were right up there. I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be really difficult to make these people kiss. how am I going to do it? But also that modern dealing with, individual, their individual wants opposed to their own calls to this bigger purpose, and how they're fitting into this world.
And even, I suppose, just the stuff that you were talking about the woman being in a place that she shouldn't be, because they're both from the aristocracy.
Yes.
They're not to meet, not to touch, not to meet alone, for example.
Which makes
them have to go slay demons at night time.
Exactly. It's quite hard to get, how are we going to get them together when actually they shouldn't be even seen together other than in a ballroom and over dinner, because that's when women and men met. So there's a lot of logistical thinking about how I can get these two characters together in a natural manner. Or could it be unnatural?
Well,
supernatural. That's right. And what about their voices? How do you, just talking about that balance again, we're used to reading novels set in the Regency era. So I guess it is, there are voices that we're familiar with from Georgette Heyer and other people in the past, which, so in a way, you are writing into that tradition. But how do you get those voices right for the modern reader?
Yeah, it's a balancing act, really. The voice on the page takes a while to develop. And for me, it's about using a little bit of a syntax flick, if you like, to get that sense of that time, but still having enough straightforwardness in the language for the modern readers. Otherwise, it gets too dense. But I do get to use beautiful words, like prodigious, things like that, you know, and lud. So that's the actual voice that I'm writing. So when I'm writing a bit of dialogue, I'm thinking, well, how can I keep it accessible, but get that sense of slight archaic formality? So that was how I was working on the page. In my head, I mean, they're chattering away.
So that's different to what's on the page.
There's a lot of me. I'm not a person who writes in cafes because I'm constantly, the characters are constantly trying out the words.
Out loud
to see how it sounds. And then I'll transfer to page and then realise that it also needs to be cut back, and it needs always to be cut back because, dialogue is a very specific thing that needs to be as cut back as possible, to get that, but still maintain that archaic flick. To its hairstyle.
So what's the job of dialogue then?
The job of dialogue. Well, I mean, there's many jobs for dialogue. Within the genre, there's the witty banter, which is part of the wooing from both sides of the character. Yeah, from both characters. There's this kind of trading off of who's smarter, who's going to win this round. But also within that is information, obviously, and there's always a kind of, and here's the plan, which of course never works out. But that the logistics of the plot within that as well. Humor, I hope that there's a lot of humor in the Lady Helen books because there's meant to be.
And they're learning about one another, I suppose, as we learn about them.
Yeah, yeah, and a lot of poignancy can come within the dialogue of. And hopefully a little bit of dramatic irony so that the character, I fully understand that my readers generally have some knowledge of the genre. So when they can see that something's coming this way, which I hope to subvert, but, you're playing around with that kind of expectation of where it's going to go. And that's fun too.
You still read Regency novels like Georgette Heyer. You still reread them?
I do still reread them.
And Jane Austen?
Yeah, still, yeah.
How many times? What's your favourite Jane Austen?
My favourite Jane Austen, very, very, but yeah. Very,
I know, big question.
It is. I think it is just because of the sheer delight of the structure is Pride and Prejudice. My least favourite is Mansfield Park. And, if you look at Pride and Prejudice, each of the main points is in a ball. That's a beautifully structured because I'm a bit of a structure nut,
And so when you are thinking about your own structure, are you thinking about those kind of points, those kind of highlight points?
Absolutely, yeah. Where are the big moments? And as I've studied more and more structure of theory and structure ideas in creative writing, I've come to the realization that the midpoint is really one of the most important points to start thinking about when I'm constructing a story. It's like the big tent pole that from everything from which it falls. It's the big point where your protagonist generally makes this huge step towards being whatever they're going to be. I think about these points. I'm constantly thinking about these points, and I'm constantly thinking about the goal and the need of those characters, and because everything swivels around those the opposition of the goal and the need for those characters, and if it's to be a what I would hope to be a meaty book, then secondary characters have their own goal and need and swinging around those as well, so that everyone is swinging around Helen because she's the protagonist, but within their own orbits is their own goals and needs that are being played out as well, and probably to counterpoint or to illustrate Helen's goals and needs. So it's a very kind of, I see this kind of galaxy of characters that are swinging around their own orbits around Helen, and you know, what are they doing, and how are they showing this particular aspect of Helen, but how is that playing out their own goal and need?
We talk about some of them, some of those people, because one of the things that's very visible on the page in these books is your interest in having characters who are not just in the aristocracy, people of working class people, and also people who are from different cultural backgrounds and people who might be queer.
Mm.
Hard to discuss without spoiling. At what point when a book has been out a few years can you talk about it freely? I don't know, but we will keep that quiet for the moment.
Mm.
Why were those characters important to you to be represented in that way?
I think that to write just within the aristocracy, within the Regency genre, would not be a modern book for me. I mean, you know, it's a modern historical genre, Regency genre. So to have a wider lens than just staying within the aristocracy was important to me. As I said, each of these characters are here to show something about the main character. So they all have their role within developing Helen as that protagonist. And so to have people of a different class would show her reactions to those people, to have people of different cultures, to have different people with people of different sexualities and orientations and things like that. So all of that was designed to be both a deeper look at that society, but also to, as I said, revolve around Helen and to illustrate Helen as the character that she is, and how she is both a woman of her age. You know, she's very firmly a Regency woman, but that she has something to say to the modern person as well.
Mm. And I suppose that those lives always were lived, not necessarily recorded and not necessarily seen on the pages of literature then.
Yes.
Or even,
yeah,
in the 20th century.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, finding information about sort of certain classes and what they wore. It's a deep dive, you know, because a lot of it is recorded. So it's getting better, of course, because more and more people are interested in those wider aspects of the era. And so there's, you know, the wonderful internet, we can get information, and more and more scholars are looking at other areas. So it's rich.
Yeah. And I suppose also it's just on a practical level, when we, the further back in history that our research goes, the fewer material artifacts there are, and the more likely they are to be from people who are wealthy enough to commission a fabulous frock, and the frock was expensive enough to hang on to,
yes,
and didn't deteriorate because it was put in a special,
yes,
mahogany closet or something.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Whereas poor people's clothes were just worn until they
dropped off.
So we have few of those.
Yeah, and I mean, we have some gowns that you can see the how many times it's been refashioned from the seaming inside, and you know, it's been, you know, let out for someone who's a bigger body and then taken in again, or, you know, cut up, you know, or cut down or whatever it is. So, you know, it's the clothing was, you know, extremely important and worn to rags, because, you know, it was expensive to buy clothing. There was nothing off the rack.
No. Everything unlike us, everybody could sew. All, yes, women,
yeah,
at least.
Well, yes, even the aristocrats did what was called poor work, and they would make little baby clothes and sew sheets and that kind of thing for the poor box. And they'd generally make the men in their life would have handmade shirts and cravats. And that's what they did when they weren't taking lessons and sitting around feeling an enormous sense of ennui.
Or slaying demons.
Or slaying demons, yeah.
So obviously what's coming through there is also a great deal of detailed historical research.
Mm.
In archives, in textbooks, I imagine. Yeah. But I know that you've got a specific interest in walking the ground.
Yes.
As we call it, in the actual, not just the experiential thing of doing the dance, but actually going to places that are important.
Mm.
So can you tell us a little bit about why you think that is important in historical research?
Yeah, look, you know, it's the subject of my PhD, actually. So
As it happens.
And I'm finding that, you know, I'm going to be interviewing a lot of historical fictional authors. And of course, there are people, and I have to preface it by saying that it's not a requirement for good historical fiction. And it is actually also a very privileged thing to do, especially when you're coming from Australia and you're going to England to do it. But for me, the interest came very early in my career, where I felt that I was missing something about the use of space for my Eon and Iona books, which are set in Asian, sort of mythical Asian or fantastical kind of Asian world. So I decided I needed to feel how space was used. And so I went to Hong Kong and to Japan and walked the ground to see, just to feel. It was literally just the sensory kind of exploration of how buildings were used and how the spaces within the buildings were used and that kind of thing. So that was the beginning of it. And sort of once I'd done that, I realized that it was part of a process that I enjoyed and that I did get something from. And my PhD is investigating, well, what do I get from it? Because there are many books that are written that people don't go to the places that they write about. So what am I getting and what are other authors getting? Because it is a practice that is, it's anecdotally talked about in, on panels and things like that, that people do this. So what are they getting out of it? And I mean, it's an interesting question for me. It is about feeling and sensing and gathering sensory information from that space. Obviously, it's the historical site, a modern historical site. So you're not getting the, the slaying thousands on the fields and things like that. But to see where these things occurred, to say, okay, and then trying to cast myself back into that time, where would I have walked? Where would I, when I say I'm casting myself back, I'm casting myself back as the avatar of my character. So when I do walk the ground, I'm generally at a reasonable length of time into my research. So I have an informed idea of that time. So that's important to me, to actually be quite informed when I'm there.
So have you written yet? Do you go?
Sometimes I'd spend a long time on getting the voice in the first few pages of the book. So there's a lot of shifting around and trying out that voice and getting it right. So I may have thought of that, but it is quite early. But the research for me is full on. And while I'm doing the research, I'm also working out the structure and the storyline, the plot line. And that's when I probably would, that's my preference, is about that point to go to start getting the sensory kind of information from those sites. Yeah.
So does that mean it is, obviously it's fact finding. You've discovered that you can't see that thing from here.
Yeah. And there's an incline here. And actually, I walked the streets of Brighton, and how long does it take to walk from here to here? Could someone run through that time? Because I know sort of like within an action adventure like Lady Helen, people are running, and how long would it take them to get there? And that's a bit long. Yeah.
Yeah. So you do the practical stuff, but also does it allow you to imagine in a different way?
I think it does. I think that, there is a, again, it's about factual, those facts feeding into how that character would be moving through those spaces. So, the wall to the sea was different And because I had that kind of information, I could go to that and say, oh, I see, you know, they would have to, they'd actually be jumping down rocks. There would be no neat steps. They were Victorian, you know, and those kind of things. So that would that stop the character from jumping down? Because ladies don't jump down rocks, you know, they kind of think so. So that would mean that when the character comes to that point, would her own sense of her own sense of class and status stop her, or would it just say, oh, who cares, and down we go, you know? So, you know, it might change her mind about something. So in that sense of, you know, what the physical environment is going to be imposing itself upon her.
Right, so you're gathering the sensory information, you're doing the practical stuff, and then what do you make decisions on the spot, write it up there, or do you just kind of process it all as you go and it ends up somehow on the page or not?
Yeah. I wish I could say that I made copious notes and it was all very systematic. but I've realised, because I've just done another lot of it, that I have the page, I have the pencil, and then I'm in the spot and I'm just soaking it up and I make a few kind of notes, and it's when I go back to it, I'm going, yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Parcel.
Yeah, thanks, Parcel. But... I have a good sense memory, I suppose, in that sense, in that way. So when I think back to walking through that, I have to process it before I start making the notes and feeling it through. So that's my process. And I would like to be more systematic about it, but I have to say I do take photos and videos and talk to myself on dictaphone things and things like that. So there are different types of notes, I suppose, being taken rather than just being that written down. So that's how I do it. And yes,
it works.
It works. Yeah, it works.
Yes.
It works. And it's, I quite like there is a shift, and it makes me work harder, because I think, what was it like? You know, how do I remember walking through that? I don't know. I like that little shift of memory work.
Huh. And does it make your prose more specific? So you can actually say, I can remember how the waves sounded. They don't sound like our waves, because they were falling on pebbles, say. And then you can work that in.
Yeah, I think it does. And you know, the seagulls in Brighton are sumo. It's like, holy moly, you know.
And they sound bigger, different.
Yeah, and they're bigger, and you know, and so a wave falling on pebbles is different from a wave falling on sand, you know, things like that. So it is those kind, and you know, the walking the lanes in Brighton, you know, how thin they are and how packed they were, and they would have been packed in those days as well, you know, because there was all these it was a busy place. Brighton was a busy place, so it was that sense of argy bargy, you know, within that world, and that closed in, because Australia doesn't have as many closed in laneways and things, and it's to get that feeling of so many people just pushing their way through these tiny little lanes, and it was great.
So we recommend that.
Yes.
So tell me what you're researching and working on at the moment, because it's more Regency.
It is more Regency. I'm moving away, I think, from the teenage protagonist, and trying out a duo protagonist of older women. And this is, people may have heard me talk about this before, but now it's coming into fruition. Is the Benevolent Society of Ill-Mannered Ladies, and I've been writing them. I bowed down a little bit to the romance expectation of protagonists who are under 30, right? I pushed it up to 30. At first I was 32, and I thought, come on, we can do better. So it was like 36. And I thought, well, no, you know, come on, 39. They're now sitting at 42. And that changes a whole lot of things, of course. The 42-year-old women, not married, with an independent income, who are using that privilege to pull women out of very bad situations in the Regency. And of course, there are many, many bad situations in the Regency for women. And so it's a joy to write. It's a hoot. It really is. I'm writing from one of the twin sisters' point of view. And, you know, I've been working with those, with that kind of the genre expectations, but also how that the age of the protagonists are subverting that, and you know, her attitude to the love interest who's just arrived in because I'm writing at the moment, it's like hilarious. And, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, she's not got a lot of patience. She's got her own intervention. She doesn't need this. But of course, you know, also playing around with the also, you know, working with the genre conventions as well, because it's an action adventure romance over three novellas.
And when you're plotting, are you plotting across all in a series? You plot across all three.
Yeah. So. In a general sense, if you know what I mean. Well, probably perhaps not. But the first one is plotted quite closely. The second one, I know what the storyline is, so I know what the case is, because each of the three novellas is a case. I know what the case is, and I know how the romantic arc is proceeding, because again, it's not insta love. It's a slow burn across, and it could be more than three novellas. It could be more. So at the moment, it's sitting at three, and I know what the third, how it will come to its end, if it ends at the third, how that will arrive. But it's very open ended, because whatever happens within the third, because although I've plotted it quite closely, I've plotted the major points carefully, but everything in between. So the characters, the character is dealing with a loss of faith. She's dealing with, you know, other things. So how those play out with it in between the major plot points of the action adventure will inform the second book, and how that plays out. So I'm very ready to shift storylines as characters make decisions according to those goals and needs.
And how far away are these novellas?
Well, I'm hoping to get the first one out early next year. And, you know, I mean, these are also part of my PhD as well, so they have to be done.
They have to be done. All right. Excellent. We love a deadline.
Yes.
Well, we look forward to that. Well, I do, certainly. And we look forward to seeing you at the conference in October.
Fantastic. And can I just say that if you're going to come to my historical fantasy workshop, that it would be great if you could read the free novella that's set in the Lady Helen world.
Okay.
And you can find that at Free Lord Carlston Novella. If you just Google that, you'll get it.
Excellent. Do that. And do that workshop.
It'll be fun.
Thank you so much, Alice.
Pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Imagining the Past. It's a showcase of some of the writers in this year's conference of the Historical Novel Society of Australasia. In Parramatta, New South Wales, from the 25th to 27th of October, the conference offers craft workshops and 2 days of panel sessions, interviews and conversations for writers and readers. You can find the 2019 conference program, book tickets and listen to more episodes of Imagining the Past at hnsa.org.au.